This is Dalit Hasig with Cancer Action Network. You're listening to Loving the Earth Pollution Free Revolution. Joining us today is a guest who has been on this radio series in the recent past. It's Kelly Franklin, and he had the experience of growing up. At the age of 1 year of age, he moved to the Canadian Forces Base, Gagetown, in New Brunswick, where a considerable amount of pesticide use, especially herbicide use, has taken place through the years. And Kelly's going to give us some background on what happened at Canadian Forces Base, Gagetown, especially with regards to the use of Agent Orange. Hi, Kelly.
Hello. Hi. Good morning. Let's see. This started in 1956 in Gagetown when they started spraying 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T, later known as Agent Orange. And our records show that from 1956 to 1964, they sprayed hundreds of thousands of gallons of this every year, with the exception of, I think it was 1961. And then in 65, they started spraying Tordon 101, which was otherwise known as Agent White. The list of what was sprayed in Gagetown and the list of what was sprayed on Vietnam during the war are the same list. They only differ by dates, but they're in exactly the same order. So I believe that all the herbicides that were sprayed on Vietnam were first field tested in Gagetown.
Well, that's very interesting. There's gradually more and more information coming out about where and how much of the herbicides, the various agents, you know, the Agent Orange, the Agent White, the Agent Blue, where these various herbicides were sprayed in both the U.S. and Canada. I've just been recently trying to obtain information on the use of these herbicides at Fort Drum here in New York State. Good. I sent off a FOIA request to the, you know, the U.S. Army, and I have not received any response whatsoever to that FOIA request yet. It hasn't been a long time, but it's been long enough that I would expect to have received a response by now. But, you know, it's, I'm sure as you are, you know, well aware, it's a long, drawn-out process of learning what actually happened, you know, the details of that. And it's because of this tremendous amount of liability that is involved for anyone who caused this to take place and was involved in doing it, just because so much harm is clearly resulting from these uses of these herbicides. Can you give us, now you've given us some background, and I'm sure the listeners are beginning to, you know, recognize the substance that we're dealing with. Tell us more. We talked some several weeks ago on the first interview you gave our group. You told us some of the damages to health that have been recognized in people who lived there with this spraying activity going on. Tell us about the kinds of exposures people were getting, you know, day-to-day, you know, specific as you can, and also what kind of disease outcomes they experienced after having these exposures.
Okay. First, I'd like to say that I put in Freedom of Information Act requests with the Pentagon and the U.S. Army, and I waited for 2 years with nothing. And finally, I was stonewalled. I did get one report, which was authored in, 2005, and it really told me nothing. So they really don't want any news about what happened in Fort Drum, all the other places in the U.S. And around the world to get out. But all right, to get to the health, I've asked a lady I know who lives in New Brunswick if she could share what she knows about it, and she told me about her cousin, and here's what she said. Mona Normand's father was posted to CFB Gagetown in 1958, which was the same year as my father. Mona was born September 24th, 1959, on the base. Mona was deaf in one ear, had a learning disability and behavior problems. Her father and brother both died young of cancer. first diagnosed with brain cancer in 2003. She was sent to the U.S. for an 18-hour operation to remove as much of the tumor as they could. By March of 2007, she began getting bad headaches again. She was now living alone in Hamilton, and Children's Aid had removed her kids as she was unable to care for them anymore. One night, the pain was so bad, she drove herself to the hospital. What she did was drive from Hamilton until her car ran out of gas in London, Ontario. The police found her lying in the snow on the side of the highway beside her car. Taken to the hospital, Mona was informed she was terminal. During her life, she had survived skin and throat cancer. Mona Norman died September 18, 2007. So that's one lady who was actually born there. And I'm just getting...
Well, it's certainly a horrible story.
Yeah, yeah.
And you say that both her father and her brother also died of cancer?
Yes. At
wow.
quite young ages.
Poor
the story of...
Suffering people.
Sorry?
Poor suffering people.
Yes. Yeah, there
it's so horrible to hear of things like this.
Well, and we don't know the whole story. This has been covered up pretty well. But a couple of stories have leaked out, like Gail Radford Ross. She's a fellow researcher, and she lives in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And she sent me the list of her health problems at present. She has hypertension, atrial fibrillation, COPD, although she's never smoked, myasthenia gravis, which is classified as a very rare disease, irritable bowel syndrome, GERD, G-E-R-D, Barrett's esophagus, vertigo, bladder incontinence for 10 years, osteoporosis, eczema, scoliosis, hiatus hernia, TMJ, Sjogren's syndrome, fibrocystic breast disease, chronic insomnia and headaches, cataracts in both eyes, and acne are what she's put down here. And many of these are shared by my mother, who is still surviving, actually. And I've heard similar tales of many of these diseases that are shared by the women of CFP Gagetown. It's a very unresearched subject, what happens to females when they're exposed to these chemicals, because, well, most of the research centers on the soldiers who were in Vietnam.
Right.
Yeah. So we represent quite a valuable resource to the world because we have, well, Western medical records, for one thing. We were exposed to the same things, and I can't understand why the world isn't beating a path to our door to do tests on us, except that maybe Canada doesn't want that to happen.
Right. Tell me, have any body burden tests been done, you know, to determine at any time, you know, say long ago or currently, what the levels of the dioxins are in these people's bodies?
No. No,
so,
it's never been authorized.
So no one knows how much of these chemicals were in these people's bodies at any one time or how much continues to be in their body?
It was kept a secret for decades. And
yeah.
I had my blood tested. I'm the only person I know who is from Gagetown who has had their blood tested a couple of years ago. And I did this with a very prestigious laboratory that's used internationally for such things. So I didn't cut corners. I actually have the details. And I'm, for TCDD dioxin, my blood is four times higher than the national average. And as you know, it's a 6, 7, 8 year half-life.
Yep.
For this stuff. So after 6 or 7 iterations, I don't know what my original TCDD level was when I lived in Gagetown, but I...
So what was the date? What was the date of your test?
I believe it was in 2007 I had it done.
Okay. Yes, yeah, like you say, that's quite a period of time for the 1950s.
Yep.
When you were born and getting a lot of exposure there. So was your mother there very long before you were born?
I was born before I got there.
Okay.
Yeah. So
yeah. No. So at least you did not have that additional exposure of your mother's body, you know, containing these chemicals before you were born. That was, you know, fortunate for you, because it's truly oftentimes the case that the disease outcome for the individual is even more terrible when the exposure takes place in utero, just because these chemicals have such a powerful effect on the developing organism and can interfere with pretty much everything that can be interfered with, and depending upon how this takes place.
Yeah. No, well, this brings up breastfeeding. That brings up breastfeeding, because you don't have to have been conceived or have been born.
Exactly. Exactly.
That you can get it from the mother well after. The studies in Vietnam have shown that this is, to put it horribly, a very good way for a woman to get rid of the TCDD in her body is by breastfeeding, because, well, the infant gets it all. Well, not all of it, but quite a bit. I'd also like to bring up, when we're talking about fluids, bodily fluids, that blood contains lipids, and the fact that many of us gave blood over the years without knowing that we probably shouldn't is another disaster that the Canadian government has caused by keeping this a secret, which leads into, I found a partial scientific report out of New Jersey. It was called the Pointman Project, and they were testing the semen of Vietnam veterans, American Vietnam veterans. And part of this scientific paper was locked up and has never seen the light of day. I believe it's in Rutgers University. I'm wondering if it didn't conclude from their tests on semen that the semen of the gentlemen who were in Vietnam also contained TCDD. And that would explain some of the health effects of these returning men on their children and on their wives, too. It's a completely unexplored subject as far as I know, but just drawing on the breast milk analogy, I'm wondering about semen.
Well, there certainly are many ways in which people can be affected by these chemicals when they last so long in the body, when relatively small quantities are so powerful in causing changes. I'm sure there's much to be learned about how a chemical like the 2,3,7,8 tetrachlorodibenzo p-dioxin affects those that come into contact with it, whether directly or, like you say, through this contact with bodily fluids.
Yes.
Tell me, so do you, you know, is there anything more you would like to share with the listeners about the health effects before we move on to what you and others are doing to try to, I'm sure it would be best characterized as what you're doing to try to bring about some kind of reasonable joint effort by government to address this problem? Any more of the health information you would like to share?
Well, I've been discovered that a lot of this has been covered up by bogus science. The story of what happened in Gagetown first surfaced in the, I think it was 1981, and quickly died because I never heard about it, and my father never heard about it. He was still alive at the time. So what happened immediately after that was a blue panel, was blue ribbon panel, I mean, was convened to study the possible health effects of what had happened in Gagetown. And that was a whitewash. I eventually found one of the reports about whether there were congenital malformations, miscarriages, stillbirths, etc., in the females of Gagetown. And there were no associations found. Another report that I found concluded that, yes, there were. In the general area, but they didn't attribute this to the chemicals that were sprayed on Gagetown. They didn't know where it had come from, and they attributed it to agricultural practices.
Yep.
So it's been covered up and deliberately not studied is all I can add to this.
Is there any research going on right now?
No. And as far as I know, nothing. Unless it's paid for by the Canadian government, and I wouldn't trust it.
Hmm. Yeah, we find that there's this illusion amongst many Americans that Canada, being such a large country with such a small population, mainly limited to the, you know, the border line with our country. You know, see, even in my case, I have had long experience with Canada. We lived right on the St. Lawrence River, you know, very near the St. Lawrence River, and my dad was the federal veterinarian that checked cattle and horses and other livestock coming from Canada into the U.S. And so we were living right there, and we oftentimes would travel to Canada to, like, see the different crops that were growing up there, you know, in the St. Lawrence River Valley, in that part of Ontario. And then my dad liked to fish up in Canada. He would go there once a year into Quebec. And then my brother was this wilderness lover, and we just gradually spent more and more time in Canada. And there's this, you know, we experienced such a large amount of this beautiful, relatively pristine, large areas of wilderness and healthy forest and these many things. And then we got into some environmental issues, and we started thinking that, oh, Canada, it's something special here about the quality of the natural world there. But then as we looked deeper and began to be involved more in specifics of these various environmental issues, it has become clear to me that even though there's lots of wonderful natural land and forest and water in Canada, the activities that involve chemicals, say the industrial activities, the waste disposal activities, some of these matters you're describing as far as use of herbicides agriculturally and in a military, you know, kind of context, this is done less carefully than in the U.S. You know, we just have so much pollution being created here in the U.S. that, you know, if you look at the totals, that would be deceptive, because really I've carefully looked at many of the Canadian laws, and they are inferior to what we have in the U.S. as far as controlling emissions from industry. And if for one, just for one example, here in New York State, we banned outdoor trash burning.
Great.
It's open waste burning, as it's described. We banned that in October of 2009. And I was recently talking with one of the agricultural kind of Ministry of the Environment in Ontario police officers, and he said that it's still perfectly legal. It's still legal for any Canadian who is like a rural resident, farmer, just backyard burner, just somebody that has a little piece of land in the, you know, the rural areas of Ontario to burn their trash.
Yes.
And that's a very productive of dioxins activity as well. So, you know, we are truly disappointed in how the government of Canada operates, both on the, you know, the provincial level and the federal level, as far as trying to limit the creation of pollutant carcinogens, including dioxins, as is the case with this open waste burning. So I hear you, and I, you know, I agree with you that Canada certainly is not a good example as far as how it deals with its poison and its, you know, its activities that involve the use of pesticides or just releasing pollutants into the environment, whether it's wastewater discharge or the air emissions. There's certainly a huge amount of work to be done in improving the record.
No, I've described it, the covering up of pollution in Canada as a cottage industry that, well, in the case of Agent Orange, they hired a company that concluded that it goes poof in sunlight, that nobody was affected as long as the spray plane passed over 800 meters away from the path of the spray plane, passed 800 meters away from that person. That
there was nothing left there once it was done.
Nothing happened after it had passed. You had to actually have been touched by it, was what Canada concluded. And this was a tremendous disservice to the world, and particularly to Vietnam. And I was very embarrassed, ashamed of my country that they had done this.
Well, I to say one, you know, good thing that I've come across.
Yeah.
It's my understanding that this group called the Hatfield Consultants,
yes.
they are Canadians.
Oh, yeah.
It's my understanding. And they have done some good work. In Vietnam, they have brought forward a lot of information, a lot of data that would lead one to be concerned about the dioxin contamination of Vietnam. And oftentimes I'm referred to this consultant group for good information on what took place in Vietnam with the Agent Orange use.
You should
so,
be.
You know,
yeah.
There are some, as is the case with all nations, there are some good people and some bad people. And I do want to, you know, I feel very strongly that many Canadians, you know, the citizens, you know, the people that live on the land, and say, for example, the Native Americans of Canada, they are so honorable and have done, many of them, so much good work to protect the environment of Canada. There are many, many, many good Canadians, including yourself and your family and your, you know, acquaintances. It's just, it seems that somehow the government of Canada has been influenced so greatly by the poisoners, those that, you know, make the pollution or use the chemicals and contaminate the land and water and the public's bodies. They seem to be especially powerful in your country.
They are.
And I'm thinking that's partly to do with our country, because the U.S. does have a lot of influence in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And I think lots of times we use our vast amount of power to control things in Canada more than we could control them in the U.S. itself. And so it turns out very badly as far as causing pollution in Canada.
Yeah, no, I can't disagree with you there. And I know that our Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, is lobbied very intensively by the chemical industry. And something just came out in the newspapers about this recently, that they get the most access to him of all the lobbyists. So, yeah, they've sold out to big companies like Monsanto and Dow. There's no doubt.
And it's even... Just yesterday, I started making some further connections with activists who are working to stop the tar sand exploitation in Alberta.
Yes.
And this is such a powerful example of the lack of any good intention, lack of any good effort on the part of the Canadian government to deal with pollution and the results of, you know, developing and exploiting a resource. It's just outrageous what has taken place there. I was talking to Dr. John O'Connor, who is the MD that works with the native population at Fort Chipewyan,
yes,
downstream from the tar sands activity on the Athabasca. And he's agreed to give me an interview.
Oh, good, good. Yeah.
And he just hearing his voice, it was so encouraging that such a good person was working with this great problem there, you know, downriver from the tar sands. And it sounds like, you know, the good Canadians are having some successes in making movies about this,
mm-hmm,
and bringing about the creation of more environmental groups that are focusing on this. This group called the Keepers of the Waters of Athabasca Society, the Athabasca Keepers of the Waters Society.
Yes.
That is looks to me like that's going to be quite a group. They have a beautiful, beautiful web page, you know, and website. Just strikingly beautiful. This Indian child, I believe she looks like Native American,
mm-hmm,
swimming in this water, and then this beautiful photograph of, I think it's some type of heron, and then just whoever did the website was just truly, you know, a great website creator. And just talking with Janice Pittman, who is the coordinator for the group, she was just so quick to offer to provide contacts and help me find people who would want to do interviews. So even though there's this ghastly environmental problem that exists now out in Alberta, where nothing really was going on much over the past the 1960s, but just to think, you know, your problem got started in the 60s.
Yeah.
Well, this problem truly was starting at the same time. Canada, you know, just having the Agent Orange use there at Gagetown, on the one, you know, one side of the country, and then out there far into the west, starting up the tar sands exploitation activity. And see, we do have these tar sands deposits in the U.S., but we have hesitated to develop them because of what has been seen happening in Canada, and also just before anything happened in Canada, you know, just people being concerned that this would be too damaging, and so the U.S. stayed away from that. In
yeah,
their...
good old Canada, bad example to the world. That's
exactly
great.
Well,
yeah.
Well, truly, it's also this fact, though, that, you know, it's not just that. It's that the U.S. certainly drove Canada into being the guinea pig on doing this tar sands exploitation. They didn't want to do it on our lands, in our states, like Montana and Wyoming and some of these other places where these deposits exist. And it's not just tar sand. There's various other kinds of dirty fuels, you know, deposits that could be exploited there. And so it happened in Canada. But then, see, we drive that because it is our purchase of this million-plus barrels of oil a day that are sourced in tar sands activity that pays for this and makes it so it's, you know, viable and gets it done.
Yeah, well, we have...
So it's really the American consumer of gasoline. And I do that. You know, I drive more than ever before. I'm willing to admit it. But see, my driving before wasn't all that much. I've always been this kind of, you know, low-driving kind of individual. So me driving more now is really not any comparison to the, you know, the average probably even, you know, user of gasoline and diesel fuel in the U.S. But I still feel bad about it. And I'm so happy that our state is now considering the development of a low-carbon fuel standard to follow the good example of the state of California. And I'm very hopeful that in California, having adopted a low-carbon fuel standard, that they are now rejecting anything that would have been sourced in tar sands activity, because it certainly would be the only way for them to meet the standard. Hope they're not cheating in any way on that.
Well, I don't know. They're building a big pipeline now from the tar sands.
I know.
I'm glad you're using that term instead of the cleaner-sounding oil sands that they're trying to get away with now. But tar sands, too... Kitimat, which is on the coast of British Columbia, and they're going to be having many, many more oil tankers coming from Kitimat to California.
And so, see, this doesn't add up. You know, how is it that California has a low-carbon fuel standard, and yet they're bringing this oil, this down there?
I don't know, but
I'm going to have to dig into this.
Canada seems to be exporting a huge amount of pollution to the rest of North America and the world, and they employ shills to cover it up. I heard one the other day talking about the tar sands, that the industry is gay friendly, with a straight face, that they're employing gays, and that the First Nations people. We're now able to buy their $60,000 SUVs. So this is all a good economic thing for Canada. I can't get past that.
It's so horrible. It's so horrible.
Yeah.
I've read the book. I read that book, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent, by Mr. Nikiforo, this Calgary journalist. It was just a fantastic book. And I only read that maybe 2 years ago, certainly sometime within the past few years. And it was very eye-opening. I had never heard of this activity. Well, I'd heard of it slightly before that because the Monk Center there at the University of Toronto,
mm-hmm.
the Monk Center on International Studies, they were having a meeting on the tar sands and its impacts on the Canadian water resource and on the Great Lakes Basin as well. And one of the media people that I know that's in this county of Oswego that's closer down that way than where we're at, he gave me the heads up that I should be looking into this matter of tar sands because I told him I was going to travel in Saskatchewan. So I went up to Saskatchewan and just gradually learned a little more about what was going on in Alberta and became very concerned that this might eventually take place in the province of Saskatchewan. It's such a beautiful, beautiful place. I would just be, like, really in pain to think that this activity was taking place on the surface of the ground there. They get so much of the acid emissions, you know, the acid precipitation from Alberta tar sands activities, the upgrading that goes on there, this coking. and these various other activities are polluting Saskatchewan, you know, right at this very moment as we speak.
We have the distinction of coining the term acid snow and toxic snow as well. Mm-hmm. And I don't know of anywhere else in the world that those terms are bandied about. Maybe Russia, I'm not sure.
We don't, so tell me about it.
Well, because the crystals form around, they have to form around some sort of particle in the air to result in snow. You've got this deposition. It's rain, but precipitation is the same whether it's frozen or not. So you've got the stuff being washed out of the air and falling as snow in Canada and other places, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, let's get back to the Canadian Forces Base Gagetown and the Agent Orange use there.
Yeah.
Tell me about the, you know, several of your efforts and others' efforts to create as much accountability from government and get as much help from government as can be accomplished.
Well, our Freedom of Information Act request is called the Access to Information Act request here. And I put in, I don't know how many now, dozens. And I've been stonewalled. And I did kind of wrest some information out of them. But they've redacted most of the good stuff, of course. They really don't want anybody to find out about this. So our activities have been, well, for the last 5 years have centered around relying on the lawsuit. There have been other activities, but very few, really. We've been relying on our lawyers. I would like to see some other efforts launched. I'd like to hold some of these people accountable and some of the agencies in Canada that are supposed to be taking care of the environment, and they're clearly failing, put in some requests that they do some inquiries. In fact, our greatest desire is to have a general full inquiry in Canada into what happened at Gagetown, because the story is huge. It's maybe the biggest story since Watergate, as far as I can tell. So every time a reporter seems to get interested in this, they put out a couple of really good stories and then disappear. But it's not because they've come to the end of their material. It's we've heard from one that they've actually been warned off, that advertising dollars from government are going to dry up, et cetera. So there's a big push that this should not be told.
How does one go about countering that? You know, I think many times we need to just go directly to the people. And that's difficult. It's difficult to do because of the, you know, how do you deal with lots of people when you don't have the, you know, the big newspaper or the, you know, the big TV station and all these things. What we have been doing here, you know, we don't have anything nearly as kind of clearly defined as this major, you know, just kind of hit you over the head, kind of really big deal. You know, this is it, you know, kind of exposure and disease type problem. You know, our problem is that we're located downstream from everything that goes into the Great Lakes, being here in the St. Lawrence River, and we're also downwind from so much of the rest of the U.S. and even the province of Ontario, province of Ontario, the kind of the heavily industrialized part, we are downwind from. So our kind of huge pollution and cancer story is more kind of, it's this more widespread type matter that's harder to get a handle on and harder to kind of like bring to the attention of the public in any, you know, compelling way. But we've decided we can get nowhere with our media, the news media here in New York State and truly in the rest of the U.S. as well, is so much the corporate news media. They're owned by corporations like Westinghouse and General Electric. You know, we're not going to get any good news out of them. They refuse to cover these matters of pollution and cancer in the St. Lawrence River Valley and elsewhere.
It's the same here.
Yep. So what we decided to do we do this radio program. We're in the process of making a movie. We're just constantly talking about this movie we're going to make about cancer in the St. Lawrence River Valley. In addition to that, we're going to start going door to door. We feel that it's important that we would at least, you know, sure, we can't survey the cancer problems of thousands of people, but we can set a good example by doing this in areas of our, you know, our county, St. Lawrence County, here on the St. Lawrence River in New York State. We can go door to door in several of the townships where we know of the existence of considerable cancer problems, you know, where everybody's talking about, there's so much cancer here. Everybody I know has got cancer, and they've all, you know, somebody died, somebody is suffering.
Yes.
We're going to go door-to-door in some of these townships and say, have a survey that we, you know, offer to the, you know, the household people there and ask them just to share with us. We don't want their health information. We just want their cancer diagnosis, you know, just this one small part of the health information. We're going to ask our fellow New Yorkers, our fellow St. Lawrence County residents to share with us so that we can put that together. And then I'm sure that in doing this, we'll learn more about the problem. We'll start thinking about what may be causing that in any particular place. One problem we have a real problem with that we're certain has contributed much cancer causation to our particular part of the world. There's this huge nylon factory that used to be operated by DuPont, and now it's called Invista, that is right across the river, just right on the banks of the river nearly, in the Maitland, Brockville, Ontario type area. It's huge. It just looks like, you know, so many sources, so many emission points, so many smokestacks and vents and pipes and all these things that are coming out of tanks and buildings and just this huge factory, and the pipes and the stacks are so low, and people have said about, you know, the smell being right on our side of the river of these chemicals, and it's just certainly a source of air pollution for the people that live in these towns of Morristown and the town of Oswegatchie that is right across the river from there.
Well, good luck. It's so sad that this isn't being done with the full resources of government. But actually, it seems to me that they deliberately are not doing it, so they can't be said to know. it's very much the same here. Very much.
I think the people, it will. It's just coming to be clear that the good people will be the ones that must and do these things, because the bad people, the government tribe, you know, they've decided, you know, there are good people in government. I don't mean to say
True.
There are no good
Yeah.
people in government.
Mm-hmm.
But the end result, where it's at the end of the day, and at the end of the month, and at the end of the year, and at the end of the decade, and as this goes on and on, the kind of the overall result is that government, in being so closely connected to industry, we have concluded that basically our federal government is industry. You know, it's so much the same that there's no point in differentiating between them.
No, same here.
The federal government here is the corporations.
Yes.
And they do not want to deal with pollution and cancer, and they're not going to. And it's our job. You know, we just feel, okay, well, we're alive. You know, we care. We love that Nickelback song from the Canadians. You know, some people say that they don't like the Nickelback. Well, I love some of the Nickelback songs. That If Everyone Cared song, and That If Today Was Your Last Day, those are certainly songs for the moment. I start every one of my cancer detectives performances that I do in the schools and elsewhere with that Nickelback song, That If Everyone Cared. I just love that song.
Yeah.
So we got that song going. I've done it at the State Fair, the New York State Fair. I've done it in high schools. We're even starting to do it now. We just feel like we want to get people excited. So we feel like that you're not going to have a revolution unless different things are happening. So we started going to the supermarkets, and they don't like it. They certainly tell us to stop. But see, the cool thing is we do it so quickly, and it's such a short little performance, and it's so tight, and it just gets the message across so well that as soon as about the time they're saying stop, we're saying, well, we're done. And there's
get
so many
there
stores.
Security arise, eh? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yep. There's so many stores, you know, so many Walmarts, so many Price Choppers, so many drug stores, so many, you know, there's thousands of them, and we live in a fairly developed area. You know, there's, you know, between me going to, like, say, to the east or to Plattsburgh, and going to the south, say, down to the Adirondacks, and going to the west over to Syracuse and this and down to Albany and all these different areas, there are thousands of stores. And so it's our intention to go to, you know, not even a large number of them, but to lots of them, and do this cancer detectives performance where we're talking about pollution and cancer. And it's so cool just to see how the people that are looking right at you, they, you know, we have a poster that gives them some information that they can read right while we're talking, and I dance. I just love to dance this kind of spiritual type dancing just to get people looking at our poster, and it works so well.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that's working in the States. I think Canadians are a bit different in that one strategy that I've been thinking of to get this point across is to embarrass Canada internationally, because we certainly are very aware of our place on the international stage, and it's a great source of embarrassment for us right now with what our prime minister has been doing, like Copenhagen, well, you name it. We've fallen down in almost every regard on the world stage. So it would be great to introduce the Canadians to just how embarrassed we should be, which I don't think a lot of people realize.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say that if you ever want to set about embarrassing a particular Canadian, the one I would vote for would be this Dr. Mark Feely with Health Canada and his role in food safety, because he was, for him to be dealing with him, for him to be the top person pretty much on food safety that involves dioxins in the food that Canadians are eating and the rest of the world is eating, he's a major player in this thing called the Joint FAO-WHO Expert Committee on Food Additives. They set the standard on dioxin in food for the world, and they set it very low just because that's what, you know, people are eating, and they don't want to, like, you know, cause them any kind of concern about the food supply contamination. And it certainly should be a concern. It's imposing more than an acceptable amount of cancer outcome on the average consumer. You know, not, you know, you guys, your people should be particularly angry about this.
Yes.
That Canada would have caused you to get this horrible extra exposure to dioxin by allowing the Agent Orange use there. And then they wouldn't even tell you that you're getting more than an acceptable amount just from the food you eat every day. They should be doing this special outreach to the members of your, you know, kind of group that was exposed at Canadian Forces Base Gagetown. They should be telling you, oh, look, well, you better be careful about how much animal fat you consume, because you're adding on this same chemical to your body burden just by consuming the food that everyone else eats on top of your terrible exposure you had in the past.
No, can't disagree with you there. I remember reading what the head of the Pest Management Registration Agency here in Canada, these are the guys that register pesticides, his little blurb in the newspaper was actually an advertisement for 2,4-5-D, or 2,4-D, pardon me. It was indistinguishable from a copy written by an advertiser. And this is the guy that's supposed to be regulating it. Well, if you look up their what they're really supposed to be doing, one of the things is promoting industry. Now, how can they do both?
Right.
I don't understand, but this is the case with a lot of the supposedly environment-watching agencies in Canada.
Well, you see, it's the same here.
Yeah.
Way back in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan was our president back in the 1980s, and I know this Long Island investigative reporter who, at that time, wrote this book called The Poison Conspiracy, and it just clearly sets forth how the Reagan administration set about placing people who were industry people at the head of the government entities which were supposed to be regulating these very industries. It was horrible. It was just this total wrecking of any kind of legitimate role for US EPA and US FDA and these various federal government regulatory agencies. And it continues to this day. To this day, our current Secretary of Agriculture, you know, the US Department of Agriculture, is headed by a former Monsanto lobbyist.
Yes.
So,
yeah, I know this. Yeah.
This is just It's so wrong. I truly, you know, what I truly like to say is viva the revolution.
Yeah.
Because we really, truly believe, I have become convinced, looking back through history, thinking about what people are like, no powerful group of people has ever given up the pleasures of their power. You know, all the money, all the prestige, all the sense of power. They never give it up without a fight. That's just human history and human nature. And I truly believe that the best thing that could ever happen would be for Canada and the United States and truly the whole world. I'd just love to see this worldwide environmental revolution that fixed all these problems.
Well, it'd be nice to stitch together a few of the different organizations and see what we can come up with, because right now we're just a mosaic, right?
Right.
Yeah, it might have the same goals, but we're not cooperating, really. And I'd love to get at least three of them together. And, well, they say a tripod is a very extremely stable base, right? And then maybe see if we can get four, and et cetera. I'm open to it. And, just from the news from the last few days, it looks like we're being forced to do something, because if I can move into what our class action is doing here, I used to say that we were sort of like the great white hope of the world, and because our class action is fighting the use of Agent Orange, and maybe what happens here would benefit Americans and Vietnamese,
exactly.
New Zealanders, Australians, Cambodians, you name it. And, we just got a communique from our lawyers the other day, and I've paraphrased this because I don't like to read somebody's email out verbatim.
Sure.
But here's what it says. There are significant difficulties with the Agent Orange case. There are problems with both the Agent Orange and other chemical warfare cases. We have more than one going on in Canada, by the way. If the courts won't grant certification in one military claim, they are less likely to grant certification in another case of military wrongdoing. The Canadian government has spent many millions of dollars fighting Agent Orange certification alone. We have applied to appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada in the Agent Orange case, but it's difficult to get leave to appeal to them on any issue. And this is a direct quote. This is the last. Overall, matters are not encouraging. So we're expecting that it looks like the government of Canada, with its bottomless pockets of taxpayer dollars, is going to triumph over our class action. So we're going to have to start exploring many different options and see where we can get, because, well, we just don't have the legal option anymore. And, you know, I'm a polite Canadian, you know, put my hand up, hello, you know. But that is not working. So we're going to have to do something more radical, I think.
Yeah, I truly, you know, just my own experience, my own sense of what people are like, my own sense of, like, where the energies lie and where things have been going. Well, I'll give you an example. There was a situation, it was in the environmental issue, they called it Dump Site 41. It was out in the Georgian Bay part of the province of Ontario, and the government had set about and accomplished. They had actually created this dump site, this hole in the ground, this huge, you know, excavation where they were going to start dumping trash. And the problem was there was lots of water in there, and there was a source of water that was very important to the Native Americans in that particular part of Canada. And so they called them the grandmothers. They just went out and barricaded the road to Dump Site 41.
Yes.
And it took them years. There were many arrests. There were meetings where thousands of people would show up at little tiny government meetings out in this part of Ontario. But in the end, the government gave it up. They allowed the natives and their allies to triumph. There's no dumping going on in the Dump Site 41. And it's because people just said no. We will not accept it. You know, it doesn't matter, like, what kind of laws you have, what kind of process you went through, what happened, whatever. It doesn't matter. It's not going to be done because it's wrong, and we won't abide it. And, you know, the cool thing was, I'm certain that a huge part of why and how they succeeded. Based on the actual reporting from people that lived through that and they've described to me, it was because of this combined activity of not only these good people, but these good spirits. You know, they're just, I believe in spiritual powers of good and evil. And in this case, there was such a clear amount of involvement of these good spiritual powers. They were just totally awesome. This one woman, she had the experience of a light coming and just, sitting isn't really the right word, but this light, whatever this light was, it just came and sat, I guess is the only way to describe it. You know, it came to be existing on her body. It just was there, and then it was with her for a while, and she looked closely at it and just thought about it, what it might mean, and then it moved from her body down onto the beach and went off into the waters of the lake. I think it's Lake Michigan there. And she felt that this was a spiritual sign. She wrote this powerful letter to the editor about this issue. She had these dreams about this beautiful kind of water spirit, this female water spirit, speaking to her and being involved with this endeavor. And it turned out so well. And I've come to believe in this kind of, you know, change taking place, that the good spirits would start working together with good people to counter these bad spirits and these bad people to win in these contests, these conflicts that are before us and that you're involved in, that I'm involved in. And I'm just so hopeful that that'll be the way it turns out.
Yeah, me too. Well, you mentioned one, I guess we could lump them in with the good spirits, was the Hatfield group. They really, really, I wish that the men like Wayne Dwernychuk would receive the Order of Canada. And I'm sorry I can't remember the names of a couple of other gentlemen that really should as well, because they've done so much for Vietnam and in raising awareness about Agent Orange in the world.
Yeah, I'm sure that the goodness in people, you know, I was just talking to a fellow activist yesterday about this. There's going to be a US EPA Science Advisory Board Dioxin Review Panel meeting taking place in Washington for the next 3 days, starting tomorrow.
Yes.
And I'm the first presenter of the public presenters at that meeting. I was lucky enough just to somehow call them right at the right moment to get
great. Yeah.
In there as the first presenter. So I'm going to talk about this matter of the time has come to have the good-intentioned people of the Dioxin Review Panel getting together with the good-intentioned people of the public here in the U.S., getting together with these good spiritual powers and taking a simple step by finalizing the U.S. EPA Dioxin Reassessment.
Well, it's been 7 years, right?
20-something. It'll be 20 years in April of 2011. It's outrageous.
Oh, I thought it was only seven. No, it was only 2003.
Started in 1991. Started in 1991, this particular draft process.
Okay.
And there were once prior to that, too. You know, it's truly a national outrage.
Yes.
That the science has been kept from the public for so long. And it's all about, during this course of this meeting tomorrow morning, there are going to be two back-to-back presentations by Dow consultants.
Uh-huh.
See, this is what we're dealing with. And yeah. the presenter that follows me is from Westinghouse. You know, it's just sick.
Yeah.
But I was talking to this one activist that's representing the Environmental Working Group, and she was saying that she did sometimes feel like it was this terrible struggle we were involved in and that it was so much this matter of politics. And it was really cool. She said, I had suggested that we get together sometime prior to the meeting and do what the Shoshone would do as far as these war dances that they would do before they entered a conflict. And she said, well, thanks for, like, giving me that thought, because I'm going to go to this meeting with a whole different attitude now.
Yeah, exercise the evil spirits.
Yeah.
And really, they are.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah.
There's no doubt that this is terribly evil, what's going on. These people, these industry people and these government people are causing many people to die unnecessarily of horrible cancer deaths because they will not bring forward what scientists know about dioxin exposure and cancer outcome in this kind of like strong way. you know, sure, we do. They say to us, well, you can educate them about it. Well, certainly we can, and we do. But it's not like having the federal government of the United States of America doing it.
Right.
And yeah. It's wrong. They're cheating people.
Well, I guess it just goes to show you that psychopaths go into the scientific realms as well. And
certainly.
Yeah.
We oftentimes say they are sociopaths.
Yes.
You know, they truly hate people, many of them. They must. Or how could they possibly be a part of doing these horrible things?
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot of mental disease out there. We're coming to see that not only is cancer caused by exposure to pollution, but many mental diseases, depression, you know, many mental diseases, some of these behavioral disorders. I'm certain that I've seen science that connects schizophrenia with exposure to certain chemicals. And I well recall the fact that people who work at hazardous waste incinerators and have these exposures to metals and dioxins and some of these very potent disease-causing chemicals, that they suffer horribly from mental problems.
Yes, yeah, and that's kind of the problem with being an activist is that, well, when you're so sick, you really can't be an effective activist. That's
okay.
A lot of our trouble because, well, people just can't participate. We can't travel, too sick. It doesn't work out.
Well, hopefully the good spirits will somehow help those of you. I'm so lucky. I'm very healthy. I have a little bit of cold today, but it's not interfering with my interviewing, so I'm happy with that. And I have not had any chronic diseases. I'm just so happy.
Really? Yeah.
To say that. Yeah, I've been very fortunate because I did eat a lot of animal fat at one time, right in the very worst of years, back in the 60s and 70s, when there were higher levels of dioxins, according to the EPA, in our food supply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We were on a small farm. My dad, being a veterinarian, he loved agriculture, and we had dairy cattle, and we drank plenty of milk and ate plenty of hamburger. But it all came from our own cattle, and so we weren't using any chemicals, other than we did use that horrible chlordane on them to kill lice and mange. And so, you know, I was getting exposed to chlordane just by using it, and then I was eating these animals that it had been used on. And in addition, all the dioxins and the other POPs, these persistent organic pollutants that are lipophilic, that were in the general environment and just entering the food supply from all these various emission points and sources, and I was eating that food that was contaminated, and we ate fish. We ate fish from the St. Lawrence River, so I got my dioxin exposure.
Yes, yeah, you did. No, there's a huge story here. I know I don't eat very much meat anymore, as from that, but if you go back in time, it was really bad, much worse than we probably even know now.
I look upon it as a case of everybody having been seriously poisoned. Now we're gradually figuring it out. See, I didn't know that. I didn't know that I'd been poisoned back when that happened.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about it being the case until the last few years. But it's all coming to be something that we're all more aware of and comfortable with, and well, not comfortable with, but able to deal with it. And so now we're just figuring out what to do about it. I keep feeling like that I should bring a lawsuit for some of the suffering that I've experienced because I haven't had... I haven't had any chronic physical disease, but I've occasionally had these really major depressions, and I haven't felt as secure about my being as I'm sure normal people would, or I would hope they would. And so every once in a while I feel myself, okay, sue Monsanto and Dow for the PCBs they put into the world, and this known kind of damaging to the, you know, the mental condition effects of the PCBs. I'm sure I could put together a pretty convincing scientific basis for this lawsuit because I do have my mental health records of going to this psychotherapist and complaining of depression and all these things, you know. I never took the chemicals. I never took any, you know, the antidepressants because I believe in thinking and doing and fixing these health problems, especially the ones that are mental. And I am happy to say that I quite far from being depressed for quite a long time now.
Good, yeah. No,
and hopefully
certainly.
That'll never haunt me again.
Yeah.
but I do think about these lawsuits. But then you're telling me about how, you know, like in the end, there's government is also the judicial. You know, in our country, in your country, in every country, I'm sure the judicial system is part of government. And then when we conclude that government is just industry and corporations, well, then the courts are just industry and corporations. So, of course, they're not going to let us win in their, you know, domain. And so we're certainly trying to come up with other avenues as well to deal with our having been poisoned and everybody having been poisoned. And hopefully we'll figure it out and just have some just fantastic result. I think what we need to do truly is just take the power away. Take the power away of the government and the corporations. And truly the way to do that is stop buying their stuff. That would end the corporations. You know, they can't exist without money. If we stop buying stuff from Monsanto and Dow to start with, that would be progress made. And then if we just stopped honoring government, started criticizing them, came a bad time every chance we got, that would just demoralize them, kind of disgrace them, make them feel like we're onto them and cause them to be nervous and upset and out of control. Who knows how far we can get with it?
Well, we're going to have a little bit of help. This is in a bad way. I've heard that because the polar ice caps and glaciers are all melting, that they're releasing their stored up poisons like TCDD, DDT, all the old favorites are locked up in the ice.
Yep.
But now with global warming, they're being re-released.
Hmm.
So this is all going to come back like a Disney movie, sort of, you know, that we're going to have to deal with it again. And I'm hoping that will raise awareness even more about just where this stuff figures in our health.
Yep. Well, I'm thinking it is a good time to say goodbye.
Yes.
And to wish you the best of luck in your endeavors. And I like your idea. Let's continue to work together and just build this activism, this poison. It's poison control because we don't want to be poisoned anymore. We want to wake the government and industry up to the fact that we will not accept any more poisoning. And it's also dealing with the effects of the past poisoning. Let's work on that together forever.
Okay, a deal.
Yep. So nice talking with you, Kelly. Good luck with all your work, and I'm sure that we will continue to have lots of connections.
You can count on it. Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Bye.
This has been one of the programs of Loving the Earth, Pollution Free Revolution. This is Don Hossig with Cancer Action Network. Our program is available on www.radioforall.net. We also are broadcast out of WMRW in Warren, Vermont. The program takes place on Tuesday afternoons at 4 p.m. I'm hoping that those who are listening want to join into our revolution, and we will be speaking soon. Bye.